for antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. All right, my friends, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. And keeping with the flow of the best guests that you could possibly hear on the radio to tell you what the hell is going on in the world, welcome back to the show, Gareth Porter. He's a historian and a reporter for IPS News Service. Welcome back, Gareth.
Thanks very much, Scott.
It's really good to have you back on the show here, and it's just like I said last time, every time you write something, I want to interview you about it, and I definitely want to discuss the Iran issue and the Cheney's insubordination and such, but I want to start, and I'll go ahead and tell the people, there's a great article that you wrote for The Prospect called The Spoiler about Dick Cheney, and we'll get to that in a minute, but I want to start with your article that we ran on antiwar.com yesterday. Sunni resistance receptive to Sadr alliance. And this, I think, is one of the most important developments in the situation on the ground there in Iraq. So I guess, first of all, for the newbies, can you basically lay down the different factions for us in a pretty brief manner and explain how this situation is different than it's been in the past?
Right. Well, you know, the major political military groups at this point, you know, beginning with those that the majority of the factions oppose is the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the jihadists who hate not only Americans but Shiites generally. Then you have the Sunni nationalist resistance, you know, many of whom, quite frankly, have collaborated with Al-Qaeda before because they're both opposed to the American occupation, but now there has been a major move by the Sunni nationalist resistance, the non-jihadist resistance against the Americans, to fight the Al-Qaeda presence in the Anbar province and other Sunni provinces. Then you have the militant Shiite faction associated with Muqtada al-Sadr, and that is considered now the second largest army in Iraq, next to the U.S. Occupation army in Iraq. And then there are scattered other Shiite militias and the very fractionated and primarily Shiite army and security forces associated with the Iraqi government, which pretty much is infiltrated by Shiite militias, including those of Muqtada al-Sadr.
Mm-hmm. And now, among the Shiites, you basically, if I have this right, you have this big split between the Sadr clan and the Hakim clan. And when there was this, when the war broke out between Iran and Iraq in the 80s, the Hakim clan all went to Iran, and the Sadr clan stayed. And so Muqtada al-Sadr and his Mahdi army are basically the guys who stayed and fought on the side of Iraq, whereas the really the most powerful, at least under American with American help, the most powerful faction is the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution, which I think you said they've changed their name, but this group that was created by the Ayatollah Khomeini, these are the guys that America has been propping up in power all along, right?
Well, that's roughly correct. Certainly the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, now it's changed its name to something else. You know, they were formed in Iran, they were trained to finance in Iran by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, came back when the U.S. Invaded and occupied Iraq, but then collaborated with the occupation and were helped by the U.S. occupation to gain power, essentially. They became the major faction in the government, the dominant faction in the government in the new Iraqi parliament. Mm-hmm. So they have basically thrown their lot in with the United States, despite the fact that they're violently anti-American. That is certainly one of the great ironies of the current and past recent past situation.
And now, the Supreme Council, they have their own army, basically their own militia, the Badr Corps. But there's also the Dawa Party, and my understanding was that the Dawa Party, even though they're basically closer in description to the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, that they didn't have their own army, and so they had made a deal with Sadr to support Jafari and Maliki and attempt to marginalize Skiri at least a little bit, but now that's come to an end.
Well, the Dawa Party is a minor faction within the parliament, and they've been going back and forth and making deals with different Shiite factions, including both the Siri and the Sadr faction.
Uh-huh. If I remember right, when Jafari became the prime minister, Abdulaziz Hakim and the Skiri guys were pushing for this other guy. I believe his name was Al-Mahdi. But then because the Dawa Party made the deal with Muqtada al-Sadr, they were able to actually get the prime minister spot instead of the Skiri guy.
Well, I want to make sure we move to the key story here instead of getting caught up too much in the details of the past.
Right. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure that there's some sort of picture of who these factions are on the ground there, so that we understand now with the news what changes are taking place.
Right.
So what changes are taking place, Gareth?
Well, now the major shift here is that Muqtada al-Sadr, who really became well known and very popular in Iraq because his Mahdi army resisted the Americans by force of arms in the spring of 2004 and then again in the summer, was defeated militarily, sort of went and licked his wounds and came back politically to then run in the parliamentary elections. And was quite successful and has 32 members of parliament, a fairly sizable bloc. And now he's been sort of poised between a threat to resume armed resistance to the occupation and a desire to be a political factor, to participate in legitimate politics until very recently. And now he has made a major strategic move just in the past 3 months, and that is to make an approach to the Sunni nationalist resistance and to offer them basically a new alliance against the occupation based on a common program in which the primary plank would be the demand for withdrawal on a timetable. So it's really to strengthen his movement, which he's been working on now for months, to demand a U.S. withdrawal. I mean, I think he believes since the Democratic victory in the midterm elections in October 2006 in the United States that the war in Iraq is reaching its endgame phase, in which the United States will, in fact, be forced politically to withdraw. So he's positioning himself to really force that issue through political maneuvering and making an alliance with the Sunni resistance is the central strategic move in that effort.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really it increases the strength of those forces within Iraq who are demanding a withdrawal, who, represent the vast majority of the Iraqi people of both Sunni and Shiite sectarian communities.
And now you say in your article that he's tactically, he's gone ahead and fired 600 members of the Mahdi army who were, he suspected of being responsible for the worst abuses against the Sunnis as part of his effort to make up with them?
That's right. I mean, he has been in charge of a militia organization, a non-governmental military organization, which is obviously made up of people who are Shiite, who are strong believers, and who have tended to take extreme positions about the Sunnis. In some cases, they may have been encouraged by Sadr, but in general, Sadr has been among the Shiite leadership. He has been the least sectarian in his outlook and the most interested in trying to find ways of collaborating with Sunnis to end the occupation. And, of course, that is because, the, as I said earlier, the other militant Shiite leaders have basically chosen the strategy of trying to use the American occupation to strengthen the Shiite-dominated government so that they could basically make sure that no Sunni political military movement could ever again regain power. And basically that meant to crush them as much as possible.
So the Badr Corps and the Iranian or Hakim factions are not interested at all in working a multi-ethnic nationalist deal with the Sunni insurgency.
That has been the consistent record for the last few years. And there's no reason at this point, there's no evidence that they have changed their view, that they've changed their fundamental strategy.
Okay, now forgive me, but I just want to dumb this down real short and sweet as best I can and make sure I understand this. There are factions who are trying to end the civil war and create a multi-ethnic government, which is America's supposed goal there. The reason we can't leave is because we have to have a multi-ethnic state and an end to the civil war before we go or something. We have that opportunity, but instead we are siding with the Iranian-backed factions who refuse to end the civil war and refuse to work out a deal for a multi-ethnic government in Iraq.
Well, yes, and I would put it a bit more strongly and more broadly that there is this possibility which the Sadr offer to the Sunni resistance organizations opposes for the United States of a Sunni Shiite alliance which would be both against Al Qaeda and against the continued U.S. military presence, and that of course is the best kind of deal we're going to be able to get in Iraq, and the United States should be supporting that. The evidence so far is that the United States has not been supportive. And I say that because, and there's no, they've made no direct comment on this so far, but the propaganda with regard to Sadr has continued to be completely negative. The effort to portray him as an Iranian puppet or an Iranian stooge certainly appears to play into a kind of crude Sunni stereotype, a crude Sunni suspicion of Shiite leaders as all being pro-Iranian, and that it is very, very commonly held view. And, you know, it does appear from the circumstantial evidence that the U.S., that the Bush administration and the U.S. military command in Baghdad continue to try to frustrate his effort to build a Sunni-Shiite non-sectarian or cross-sectarian alliance because essentially they want to fend off any pressures for U.S. Withdrawal, for a timetable for withdrawal.
Right, so we're backing the only people who need us to keep them in power.
That's pretty much the size of the situation, right.
Wow. So what an unbelievable pile of lies the American people are living in right now. Then this surge is supposed to tamp down the violence, and then we can have a diplomatic solution to the problem is what we're being told. We have to wait till September to find out if it's going to work or not. And, of course, Bush has said that we'll know it's working because the violence has fallen, or we'll know it's working. I'm sorry. And he's also said we'll know it's working because the violence has increased, and that just proves how desperate they are because of how good of a job we're doing.
Well, there's some interesting clues to suggest that my earlier hypothesis that the surge was never intended or expected, let me put it that way, never expected to actually succeed in stabilizing the situation or to help support or precipitate a new phase of negotiations or a deal between the government and the Sunnis, was in fact quite accurate. And that is, in today's Times, there is an article by Max Boot, the neoconservative, which just states quite flatly that that there's no possibility that there's going to be any kind of settlement coming out of the Shiite government and the Iraqi parliament. There's not going to be any real action on all these items that are supposed to be indicators of progress toward an end to the sectarian conflict. I mean, he's quite frank about that, and you can be sure that reflects the inside views of people within the administration and in the U.S. command in Baghdad.
So what's the surge for? Just to cleanse all the Sunnis out of Baghdad?
Well, I mean, my view is that Bush, after the elections, decided that he did not want to be, you know, hooked with the failed war in Iraq, and therefore was determined for the next 2 years to pretend as though he were still going for success. And so everything that he's done basically since December, when he suddenly renounced the unanimous view of his Joint Chiefs of Staff and of the commanders in Iraq and hand-picked a crew that would go ahead and do something completely different, is aimed at simply maintaining the fiction that he is going for victory, for success, knowing all the while that all he's going to do is hand this off, or hope to hand this off, to his successor in January 2009, and so that he can blame his successor for the defeat, pretty much knowing that it's going to be a Democrat, by the way, instead of having it be on his watch.
Yeah, well, if America was defeated, if all the Iranian parties, but if the actual Shia Iraqis all just grab their AK-47s and join the Sunni insurgency, and the American military was forced to withdraw to Kuwait, or as much of it as is left, in that hypothetical, now America's out, Bush is completely lost and defeated, it happens a month or two from now, is Al-Qaeda going to take over the Al-Anbar province and the Sunni areas of Iraq without American presence there to protect us from them?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, the Al-Qaeda is a significant force. There's no question about that in Anbar and other majority Sunni provinces. But they are still a minority of the total Sunni resistance forces. And they're able to maintain the position, that the prominent position they now have in the resistance, simply because of the American, a complete refusal to withdraw from the Sunni provinces. And in my story that you published yesterday, I mention reports that have been, report that was made by an officer, a special operations officer, who had just returned from 8 months in Anbar province. And after conversations with the Sunni sheikhs in the province, who generally reflect the viewpoint of the nationalist resistance, not so much the Al-Qaeda people at all, he said that the Sunni sheikhs are saying the American military has to withdraw. They have to withdraw soon. They can't hang around. They said to the American military contacts they had, "We know how to handle Al-Qaeda. Don't worry about that. We can handle that."
Right, and we've proven
this,
that we can't.
By the way, this conflicts with the prominent view that the Sunnis generally now want the Americans to stay to protect them from the Shiite majority. That's simply not what the Sunnis are saying at all.
Mm-hmm. And now, America has, whether they asked for that or not, America has sort of put ourselves in that position. I remember in 2005 when... I believe it was Talabani and Hakim together said, "Hey, why don't we join our Border Corps and our Peshmergas together and we'll go crush that Sunni insurgency?" And America said, "No, no, no, thanks, but no thanks." I guess what you're saying is the Sunnis know now that they're dealing with Sadr and his Mahdi army, not with the Border Corps, and that they're not worried that Sadr will try to conquer the Sunni areas, whereas they would be worried that the Border Corps would just try to come and completely conquer them.
Well, I think that they've never really been afraid that the Shiite army would be capable of going into Anbar and Diwaniya and other Sunni provinces and actually successfully occupying it without the Americans there to support them and to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think that they have ever really taken that very seriously. I think, you know, what we have is, in effect, in Iraq, we have a standoff with the Shiites having basically largely succeeded already in cleansing those parts of Baghdad where the Sunnis had had a major population within the predominantly Shiite neighborhood. the Shiites have consolidated control over their areas of Baghdad, and basically they do control most of Baghdad now. But the Sunnis are firmly in control of their part of the country, and they know the Shiites are not powerful enough and won't be powerful enough without the Americans in the fight to have any chance of occupying. I mean, the Americans were not capable of doing it. How could the Shiite military possibly succeed in doing that? So really, the major argument, both the major arguments against withdrawal, which are, you know, that the Shiites would crush the Sunnis and that the Al-Qaeda would gain complete power in Anbar and other Sunni provinces, are simply bogus.
Uh-huh. And now, if America withdrew, would Skiri be forced to go back to Iran and Sadr would be the unquestioned dominant power among the Shiites?
There's no doubt that he would be the most popular and the most powerful figure in the Shiite community. Yes, I mean, there's little doubt about that. The other militant Shiite leaders, particularly Hakim, are not that popular, and they have actually lost popularity since the first parliamentary election. They have been pretty much discredited as failing to make good on their promises. Mm-hmm. So there's no doubt that Sadr is much more powerful today than he was a year or two ago.
I'm trying to think of if there's any more excuses that are being used to keep us in that country that are lies that we can go ahead and debunk while we're at it.
Well, I think those are the two major fictions that have been used to buttress the case for staying mm-hmm. in Iraq. Those are the ones that you hear in one shape or form or another in Congress and the media.
Right. Okay, well, now let's get right to the spoiler, Dick Cheney. That's a good name for him. I guess if there was a comic book of this administration, he'd be the spoiler. It's your recent article for the American Prospect, and I guess let's go ahead and start with the breaking news from Steve Clements and the blog at the Washington Note. I discussed this a bit with Ray McGovern in the last hour. Basically, it seems Cheney is deliberately leaking around Washington, D.C., that he doesn't have confidence in George Bush to do the right thing and bomb Iran, and that he wants to make an end run around and get Israel to start the war for him and force George Bush to have a war.
Well, that report certainly is very credible, given what we know about Cheney and his firm commitment to trying to have a military option be exercised against Iran. And his well, let's put it this way: he represents the dark side, if there ever was one, in the U.S. Government. And you know, it's interesting this situation where Bush has not yet exercised, not moved to the military option, and Cheney now reportedly being upset about that. It's an interesting parallel for me with Vietnam policy in late 1964 and early 65.
Oh, really?
When Lyndon Johnson was under pressure to bomb North Vietnam, and he didn't want to do it. In fact, he was increasingly opposed to it after his election as president in November 1964. He became adamantly opposed to it, and his top advisors, particularly Robert S. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, and his National Security Advisor, McGeorge Bundy, became increasingly upset, as did other high officials, that Johnson was refusing to go ahead with the bombing that they were all convinced had to be done. And in the end, basically, you know, they decided to approach Johnson and tell him that his policy of passivity was unacceptable, and to hint very strongly that they would not be able to support him if the cause in South Vietnam was lost. So he felt that he was under terrific pressure. Now, whether Bush is going to feel under that kind of pressure from Cheney is another question. I think the political situation is so totally different now that Cheney is really swimming upstream on this one. With every passing month, it becomes much more difficult for him to push his line successfully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's especially difficult, it would seem, when really the best they can do is try to make Iran seem like it's a nuclear threat, and yet even TV news now will admit that I saw Shepard Smith on Fox News yesterday say that Iran is 8 years away from a nuclear bomb. So, how do you get a population shaking in their boots over something like that?
Yeah, I think it's a very difficult case to make and becoming more difficult all the time. Cheney cannot be ruled out of the game. I think it's too early to do that. And Cheney would obviously go to George Bush and say, if in fact this report reached the White House, he would simply deny it. And his relationship with Bush is such that he might well be able to convince George Bush that this is simply a liberal media lie. He certainly still is able to talk with Bush, still able to get him to listen to his side of the story. As recently as last September, October, I point out in my article that Bush was convinced to begin this hardline policy toward Iran, and there's no doubt that Cheney was a key factor in that. And even with the beginning of the direct talks with Iran, Cheney has succeeded in making any real progress in those talks, or even any meaningful beginning of serious negotiations, unlikely, by essentially holding on to these Iranian officials that were seized in Erbil in Kurdistan last January.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, more and more, if you look at it, that was a way for Cheney and his minions in the administration, his allies and acolytes in the administration, to make sure that even if Rice was able to get acceptance of direct talks with Iran, which she has done since early this year, those talks would come to nothing. And in the end, he could then go back to Bush and say, okay, now we have to go back to the military option.
Mm-hmm. So basically, and if I remember right, those are some very high-level Iranian intelligence guys that were seized, right?
No, they weren't high-level intelligence guys. I mean, these were low-level
Am I thinking
Iranian
of a different abduction?
Pardon?
Am I thinking of a different abduction of Iranians? Because I thought that there was one of these that didn't Patrick Colbert write in the Independent.
Well, they were after two higher level officials.
Oh,
they
but
didn't
missed them.
They
right.
had to settle for much lower level people.
Right. I'm sorry. I'm conflating two stories together here, aren't I? Okay. But you're right. Basically, what you're saying is Rice says, look, George, you got to let me go talk to these guys. And he says, okay, Condi, go ahead and talk. Cheney has some people kidnapped, so now that's basically one more issue that Rice has got to settle. It's basically a deal breaker for any progress that she wants to make with Iran.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you're serious about beginning talks with Iran, obviously you're going to have to eliminate the spoiler, which is exactly what they are, these prisoners that are being held. And this was discussed within a few days after the Iranian release of the 15 British sailors and Marines on April 4th, the obvious question for the Bush administration was, well, what are we going to do with our prisoners now that they've unilaterally, without any conditions, released the British? And Rice reportedly said, well, it's time to release them. They're no more value to us under these circumstances. And the vice president, the agent in that meeting, said, no, we want to hold on to them. We want to convince the Iranians that we might even take more of these prisoners. And so in the end, Rice apparently caved in and accepted what was called a consensus at that meeting, according to a Washington Post story on it, which obviously came from Rice herself.
And now, didn't The Guardian report that during that crisis that the military had probably, I assume under Cheney's instruction, the military had offered to the British, hey, what do you want us to bomb? Let's see if we can turn this into a war right now.
Well, I didn't see that report. I would be a bit hesitant to accept that because I think by mid-March, it was March 23rd, they were captured by the Iranians. I think the administration had already begun to back off the more extreme belligerence toward Iran. So I'm a bit reluctant to say, yeah, that's what was going on there. My view is that the administration had already decided by March 23rd that they were not going to be provocative, that they were trying to promote talks with the Iranians. That was a shift in the at least the declaratory policy of the administration. Mm-hmm. Because you'll note that there was absolute silence from the White House and from the Defense Department for the first few days, and then the first real statement that was made was by Secretary of Defense Gates on March 26th, and that statement was really quite conciliatory toward Iran, despite the fact that this was a golden opportunity for the administration to beat their breast and shake their sword at Iran over the capture of British military personnel. So, you know, it looks very much like a decision had been made for whatever reason by that time not to sound the belligerent, the note of belligerence that they had in January and February.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were on the show last week, you talked about Admiral Fallon and how basically he had made it clear that he would resign rather than prosecuting this war. And Wednesday I talked with a former CIA counterterrorism officer named Philip Giraldi, who said that he had heard the very same thing, I guess, from his sources confirming that. And I guess we all like to hope that that's a deal breaker, that if the head of CENTCOM resigns rather than carrying out the war, that that'll basically make the government, make Bush and Cheney put it off.
Well, yes, that is certainly to be hoped, that people like Fallon, who's, you know, obviously in a very, very powerful position as a commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, to say no to any aggressive move toward Iran. And I should just add, by way of clarification, that in my story, I did not report that Fallon actually said that to the Bush administration, to
right.
the White House, that he would resign if they were going to try to go to war against Iran. What he said was to a private individual who spoke with him at that point. So he was really in confidence saying that that was his position. Now, you know, I don't think this is the kind of thing that if you're commander-in-chief of CENTCOM, you're going to be talking about necessarily to the White House. I think what he would be doing is making the arguments against the kind of military moves that were being proposed by the White House and, you know, privately, you know, maintaining that position, being ready to put his career on the line if it was necessary.
Mm-hmm. And now this report by Steve Clemens has it that on the side of Condoleezza Rice is, Negroponte and a couple others at the State Department, the head of the CIA, Hayden, the National Intelligence Director, McConnell, and the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, that they're all on the side of Rice, and it's Cheney, Hanna, and Wurmser are on the other side, I guess, and Hadley.
Well, I think that sounds reasonably accurate in the sense that all of those people believe that a military assault on Iran would be madness. There's no doubt in my mind that that's the case. And of course, you know, that does help to constrain Bush in various ways, because to the extent that all those people are in agreement, they're able to structure the discussion and the options and so forth so as to discourage Bush from moving in that direction. But again, part of the problem is that Cheney is right there in the White House. He has Bush's ear. He has in the past had a special position in U.S. National security policy, which is that he had a veto power over other people's speeches, that he had the right to review other people's speeches, but the other people in the administration did not have the right to review his. And this, I must say that there is some evidence that at least part of that special position still pertains today, because when Cheney went to the Persian Gulf and declared, you know, made his declaration warning Iran, and again, you know, referring to the military option from the deck of this USS Stennis, he was doing so from a speech text that was not reviewed by anybody else in the administration, certainly not the State Department. And that does suggest that the special position, the veto power that he had before, and his ability to make speeches at least his ability to make speeches without being reviewed by others in the administration still pertains. So that is a cause for continuing concern.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't remember, if this comes from the Washington Note or if this comes from Justin Raimondo's article about it that's on antiwar.com right now. I think it may have just been Justin's speculation that the recent leak to Brian Ross at ABC News about Bush's new finding authorizing the CIA to sabotage the Iranian economy, finance dissident groups inside the country, and that sort of thing, that may have been part of this whole scheme, that leak may have came from Dick Cheney in order to disrupt any negotiations as they stand now.
I think that's absolutely right. I'm reasonably sure that that's where the leak came from. It was not from hostile sources within the CIA or other parts of the government. It was to underline the toughness of the administration on Iran.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when and this maybe is something that we talked about last week, but I don't care. I think it's important anyway. When Cheney gave that speech from the USS Stennis in the Persian Gulf, he said, "Iran, make no mistake, we will keep the sea lanes here in the Persian Gulf open no matter what." Well, nobody's ever said anything about Iran being a threat to the open sea lanes of the Persian Gulf except in response to a possible American aggressive war against them.
Well, that's absolutely right. Of course, you know, we should be aware that that kind of rhetoric and that sort of playing with the truth, you know, pretending as though, you know, the state with which the United States has a conflict has aggressive intentions to, you know, shut down the sea lanes or, you know, prevent trade from going through the sea lanes is the oldest trick of the military and its allies in the U.S. government. They've been doing it ever since the beginning of the Cold War. So there's nothing really very new about that. It's just that in this particular instance, you know, it has drawn a great deal of attention for obvious and good reasons.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you and I both have proved over and over again that all these stories about the new explosively formed penetrators, the roadside bombs that are so good they need a new acronym, you and I both disproved the idea that these must be coming from Iran. Everybody knows, even Shepard Smith on Fox News now knows that they are at least 8 years away from an atomic bomb. And, of course, that means if they kicked out the IAEA and started trying now, which they haven't done. So let me ask you, Gareth Porter, in your expert opinion, why is Cheney so hell-bent on war with Iran? Because, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think he really cares that much about the Jews. I don't think that he's a big partisan of Israel. So what the hell does he care if everyone else in the entire establishment in his own administration is against this? What the hell does he want with Iran?
Well, this does begin to look like a kind of Ahab and the great white whale. Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a degree of mystery surrounding the degree to which Cheney is so obsessed with a military option against Iran. I would say that there is a cast of mind which goes well beyond Cheney, which involves, you know, people in the Air Force, people in the Pentagon, reflecting Air Force views, who have been interested in sort of cutting Iran down to size for some time. And frankly, you know, that's what this is all about. It's an opportunity to eliminate Iran as a power in the Gulf by, you know, really hitting not just, you know, really it's not about nukes at all, as I said before. It's really about reducing Iran's power, hitting its military installations, hitting key economic targets, basically pushing Iran back several years or a decade or two in terms of its power position. So in a way, you could view this as just a kind of extreme variant of the kind of thinking that goes on all the time in the Pentagon, which is, what can we do to reduce the power of our rivals, of our of those states that are in our way, those states that are not supporting our interests?
So not necessarily so much keeping the resources for ourselves, but just making sure that they don't fall into the hands of near peer competitors, as Paul Wolfowitz calls
it. Well, I mean, this is one of the places where I think I part ways with many critics of U.S. Policy in the Middle East. I do not see it as resource based. I don't think it has to do with resources. I think it's much more based on power for its own sake. And of course, you know, resources are viewed as part of power. No doubt about that. But in a way, it's much more irrational than calculating. I mean, it seems to me that much of the analysis of Middle East policy that says that it's all about the oil is assuming that there's a degree of rational calculation here, which I just don't see. I think it's much more crude, much more irrational.
As O'Brien explained in 1984, power is not a means, it is an end.
Exactly. It's power as an end in itself.
Isn't that very interesting? Because, you know, this has thrown a lot of people for a loop. You see Henry Kissinger and James Baker and Zbigniew Brzezinski and, you know, people who represent the permanent American establishment. Basically, I remember, I don't remember which Sunday morning news show it was, where James Baker said, you know, our strategy toward Iran is crazy. Like, you know, waving his hands in the air. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Right. And, of course, Baker is at the epicenter of the oil industry viewpoint, and if you go back back to 2003, and you ask where James Baker and the oil companies were on the question of invading Iraq, they were opposed. They were absolutely opposed.
Right, they wanted a coup, not a big massive destruction.
They basically wanted to make a deal with somebody there, which would avoid violence, which, you know, the market doesn't like.
Right. Yeah, and what an insight. I remember Cato, I guess 2 or 3 years before September 11th, I think it was, the Cato Institute did a study where they said, well, this is how much money the American taxpayer spends, quote-unquote, securing our oil resources in the Middle East,
right.
And this is how much we actually spend on the oil, and they were roughly the same. We were basically paying double in order to guarantee and secure, supposedly, all these resources, which would all be for sale anyway. In fact, Michael Scheuer even quotes Osama bin Laden himself saying, look, we can't drink it. No, even if it's me, I'll sell it to you.
Yeah, that's a pretty good piece of evidence against the idea that it's all about the oil.
Right, yeah. Or all about anything rational, really. I like
the
way you say that. This is about Dick Cheney and his personality.
Yes, it's more about Ahab, I think.
Uh-huh. And, you know, as long as we're kind of winding down the clock here on Cheney and his sick and twisted personality, I have a little anecdote for you, Gareth, which you have probably no way to verify, so it's just interesting. I know a kid who his father was a Kellogg Brown and Root Halliburton guy. And apparently they all knew this was just kind of the story, the rumor, the gossip going around at Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root, that there was this one Vietnam War helicopter pilot who had been pictured on the cover of Time magazine. It was very famous, a frontal view of this guy's Huey. And anyway, so he was a very famous and very accomplished helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he worked at KBR. And apparently Dick Cheney would call this guy into his office every week to make him tell old war stories over and over, like always the same stories over and over and over again, like he's just some madman.
Well, that's a very interesting story. I find it quite believable and also very insightful in a way, because of course Dick Cheney was one of the people who was a chicken hawk,
uh-huh.
who kept out of the war, but whose whole career has been based on the idea that you know, we need to do more of the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to kick the Vietnam syndrome and have more Vietnams, more Iraqs. So there is a degree of irrationality there, which certainly I think that helps to illustrate.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people are just like that. My old friend Anthony used to watch Saving Private Ryan every day. He said he just was sure that in a former life he was a soldier that died at Normandy or something, and he was just stuck that way in this permanent loop watching Saving Private Ryan, and that sounds about like Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
You know, same kind
something,
of thing. Tell me about that time that you killed all those people. Tell me about that one time. Over and over again. All right. Well, I sure appreciate your insight, as always. Everybody, Gareth Porter is a historian. His latest book is The Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to Vietnam. He's got a new one in The Prospect called The Spoiler about Dick Cheney, the American Prospect, I should say, and writes for IPS News Service. Thanks again, Gareth.
Thanks for having me again, Scott.